Hello, and welcome to Episode 5, the anniversary edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat, the podcast that covers the arts in Northern Chautauqua County, sponsored by the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. My name is Tom Laughlin, and I'm your host as we bring you news and information about arts events at the Opera House and around the region, as well as interviews with artists and creators across the county. It's hard to believe, but on Friday, November 12, 2021, the 1891 Fredonia Opera House will be celebrating its 27th anniversary of its reopening in 1994 as a performing arts center. Like the proverbial phoenix rising from the ashes, the Opera House rose from being called a bat cave to becoming one of the crown jewels of downtown Fredonia. Its survival all these years is really a tribute to the Fredonia, Dunkirk, Northern Chautauqua community's support for its programming and contributions to the cultural life of the region. Later in the podcast, we'll have a chance to listen to a conversation I had with Mr. Jim Boltz and Dr. Dick Gilman, who are perhaps the two most prominent individuals responsible for the renovation of the Opera House. Their vision and dedication is apparent as they talk about what it took to bring the Bat Cave back to life. Also on this episode, I'll be talking with Dr. Robert Strauss and Mr. Dan Lenzian, who are respectively the producer and the stage director for the Hillman Opera's upcoming production of Il Matrimonio Secreto, or The Secret Marriage, by Domenico Cimarosa. I think their conception of the production will leave you, intrigued. But we'll start off the podcast with a look at the upcoming Fredonia Opera House stage on screen production of the classic ballet Spartacus, performed by the Bolshoi Ballet. Spartacus will be shown on the big screen at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House on Saturday, November 20th at 1 p.m. I was fortunate to get one of the region's most knowledgeable people when it comes to dance, Ms. Angelica Summerton, to discuss it with me. Not only does she give us some insight into the world of ballet and the Bolshoi itself, but she also talks about the upcoming Fredonia Dance Ensemble's second weekend of their fall chamber concert being performed at the Merrins Dance Theater in the Rockefeller Arts Center at SUNY Fredonia. I'm really pleased to welcome Ms. Angelica Summerton, otherwise known as Gailey Summerton. She is a senior lecturer in the Department of Theater and Dance in the dance program. Welcome, Gailey. It's good to have you.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you for inviting me to this podcast.
Oh, you're more than welcome. It's really a pleasure to hear your voice. So let's start off. We got a two-pronged deal here, but let's start off with the Live on Stage Bolshoi Ballet. The Bolshoi Ballet is something that I think people, they know the name, they hear the name, they go Bolshoi Ballet. And if they recognize it, they know that that's probably like the dance company in the world, but they don't know too many details about it. Can you clue us in to let us know what the history of it is and how significant it is?
Oh, sure. The Bolshoi Ballet is among one of the world's oldest ballet companies, and it was actually founded in 1776, but it really didn't achieve recognition until Alexander Gorsky took over as ballet master in 1900. And then over the following decades, the company has developed its own unique identity. And then the another boost to the fame for the company came through Yuri Grigorovich in 1964, who for over 30 years was a dancer, choreographer, and for the Bolshoi Ballet. And he also dominated the Russian ballet scene for a very long time until his retirement in 1995. Yuri Grigorovich was very much influenced by the Soviet regime at that time, and so were all the productions. And since he had retired, the company has actually absorbed also more modern versions of ballets and has presented modern dance concerts as well.
The Russian culture is such that things like poetry, art, and ballet are very meaningful for them. I mean, the Bolshoi Ballet is one of those cultural institutions in Russia that's almost sacred, isn't it?
Definitely, yes. They cherish their Russian artists, whether it's musician, visual artists, dance artists, all kinds of performing artists. And you see it in the stories in the more traditional ballet, such as Spartacus and other productions.
Are the dancers that we're familiar with, they all danced at the Bolshoi, didn't they?
I don't know 100%. The names did not come up when I did my research. And they're sure very famous, Nijinsky and Baryshnikov and Nureyev. But the other names, such as Galina Ulanova, come up all the time. And she is frequently cited as being one of the greatest ballerinas of the 20th century. And she danced at the Bolshoi. And so was Maya Plisetskaya, also a Russian and Soviet ballet dancer, as well as a choreographer and ballet director, and also actress. She passed away in 2015. Other names, for example, are Ekaterina Maximova, and she was also very famous in the 20th century, in the second half of the 20th century, and she earned international recognition and fame. And some people may remember Alexander Godunov. He was a Russian-American ballet dancer and also film actor. And he was a member of the Bolshoi Ballet. And in 1979, he actually defected to the United States. And currently, one big name that comes up quite often is Natalia Osipova. She is also a Russian ballerina and currently as well the principal dancer with the Royal Ballet in London. And so the list is very, very long. And the Bolshoi Ballet Company actually maintains a wonderful website in English, and you can go and research dancers and directors and big names. So they have a wonderful website there with all kinds of history and pictures and names.
I'll link that website in the description when I get that done. That'll be great. People can go and take a look and get a little bit more background. Yep. Ballet itself, the talk about the art form a little bit. It is, you know, whenever I see it, I'm always just stunned by it. It's combination of incredible athleticism and you know, just grace. What is it that makes ballet such a compelling art form?
People love to be transformed into some type of a surreal world. And I think it's following a story that is entirely told through movement and music is a wonderful thing rather than just reading. And it's quite an experience to see life dance, whether it's in a big theater or in a small stage. And I think a lot of people also appreciate the tradition of the classical art forms, whether it's just music or in any dance style, or I think it's the excitement is about the live presentation of classical ballet. And for me personally, who has studied classical ballet, I'm always fascinated by the craft of it. And I admire the physical ability and the beauty of the lines, and which is created through classical ballet.
A lot of modern ballet performers are really stretching the limits of the athleticism, the leaps, the height of the leaps, the spins. It's almost otherworldly, I think, is the way I look at it.
Well, over the past couple of decades, classical ballet has definitely evolved, and the physical demands on the dancers have skyrocketed. So today's classical ballet dancers, who actually enjoy a little bit more science, they're helped by science, are much more athletic and with higher extensions and more turns and pirouettes than maybe two or three generations earlier. So the demands are just out of this world.
Yeah, they really are. I think the amount of years that you have to spend training and what you have to do to your body to be able to get to that point just has got to be almost inconceivable.
It is. It is.
Yeah, I can barely get my leg up on a bar. The other thing I tell you I find about ballet these days is that the passion that the dancers put into it seems to be a little bit more than maybe two or three generations ago. You just get the sense of movement that is far more, you know, passionate and really, you know, gets to the emotion. It doesn't seem to be as sort of, you know, a little bit more formal than not letting those emotions let go.
Well, I'm not sure if I agree with it.
That's okay.
I think the passion has always been there, and it's probably a matter of interpretation, and it the interpretation is usually directed by the director or by the choreographer, and he tells the dancers how to dance and how to show emotions. And then quite often solo dancers are entitled or have the chance to express themselves. And there are certain roles that are very particular to certain famous dancers. And I think the passion has always been there for classical ballet. And of course, interpretations change over decades. The looks of certain ballets change. And I would say passion is always there.
Passion is always there. Okay. Yeah. That's good. All right. All right. I'll have to look for more of it in some of the older ones that I'm familiar with. Yeah. One that's coming up in the Opera House is Spartacus. And to tell you the honest truth, it's a ballet that I had never heard of before until I saw it was coming up. It's Spartacus. Well, you know, and everybody's familiar with the, you know, the Kirk Douglas movie and everything like that. So is can you give us a little background on the ballet? How is it different? What story is it telling?
Well, Spartacus is based on a novel by the same name by Raffaello Giovannoli. And there have been several versions, actually. The very first version of the Spartacus ballet was presented in 1956, and there was another one in 1958. But the one that we are probably going to see in the film is by Yuri Grigorovich, and he created this version in 1968. And this is the one that has become one of the company's signature ballets. And it is a spectacular, but also tragic ballet in three acts. And it's about 3 hours long.
Tell me a little bit about the score. It was done by the ballet was scored by Aaron Khachaturian. And can you tell me a little bit about how he developed the score? What are some of the particular things that people can listen for, you know, in the score as they watch the dancers?
Yeah, this Aram Khachaturian composed the music for Spartacus in 1954, so about 2 years prior to the first version of this ballet. And I did a little research, but I really couldn't find that much information about the music itself, other than it's wonderful music. I've heard and read about it. I have not listened to it, but he also extracted and arranged music from this ballet in 1955 and created four orchestral suites. Mm-hmm. And they're just called Spartacus number 1, 2, 3, and 4. And in these suites, you can hear sections from the ballet and their introductions, the adagios, the variations, several scenes throughout all of these individual suites, and back to back they tell the story of Spartacus.
Right. Okay. So, you know, that's good. I think that people are really going to sort of enjoy it. I mean, I've seen a few sections of it myself so far. Like you say, YouTube is a very good resource for it. And but I'm always fascinated because the name Bolshoi Ballet is so ingrained in the arts world that if people don't get a chance to see it on the stage, the live on stage, it's hard to get a chance to see it live for sure. Now, the other thing we're here to talk about for you particularly is that the Fredonia Dance Ensemble has a concert coming up. You're going into your second weekend of a chamber concert in the Marin's Dance Studio. And give us a little taste of that.
Yeah, Tom, thank you for letting me talk about this. So the final three performances of the fall chamber concert are held in the Marin's Dance Theater and Rockefeller Arts Center at SUNY Fredonia. And the dates and times are Friday, November 12th at 7:30 p.m., Saturday, November the 13th at 2 p.m., and also at 7:30 p.m. The tickets are $7 for students and $15 for the general public. And they are available at the box office in the Williams Center. And I'm pretty sure also at the door, but that is only if the shows are not sold out. And this particular performance features two guest artists and two faculty choreographies. And the first piece was created by guest artist Naila Ansari, who is an assistant professor at Buffalo State University. And her piece is recognizing African-American women who have made major contributions to jazz dance. The title of her choreography is Say Her Name. Now, the second piece is actually my choreography and is called FLAD, or broken, or you can also read it flat, broken. And I created this choreography around the emotional and physical effects of fear, loneliness, anxiety, and depression. And these are emotions that we all have to deal with in some way or at some point in our lives. But no fear, the choreography is going to end on a positive note. The third piece is a work by another guest artist. His name is Christopher K. Morgan, who currently works in Washington, D.C. And he staged a very intriguing choreography using powerful lights that the dancers are manipulating through movement. And his choreography is called Limited Visibility, and it's quite a spectacle. So you don't want to miss this one. Now, the final piece in the last work was created by Professor Anthony Alterio, who is also the director of the Fall Chamber Concert. And the title of his choreography is Dio, which is, I believe, Italian for God. And you will see a high energetic, very upbeat piece with five dancers and a couch.
A couch?
So, a couch, yes.
Okay.
A couch. I say no more. You have to come and see it. I did not know you can have so many possibilities dancing with a couch.
So. Well, that makes it even more intriguing. I'm always fascinated, and I've said this before, and I'll say it again. The thing that always intrigues me about watching dance concerts is just that they're constantly original. They're constantly something yes. new is always showing on the stage.
Yeah, this is very true for the contemporary dance world. And you're right. I can't send for a script and, you know, invite the music. I have to find the music for myself, or every choreographer has to do this. And it's always new. It's a lot of work. But it's always an experience to see it. It's always new. It's always fresh. It's rarely recycled.
Yeah. Gaylee, thanks a lot for joining me. I appreciate it very much. And good luck with the second weekend. And I hope everybody enjoys the concert. I'm sure they will.
All right. Thank you, Tom.
Okay.
Have a good day.
Thank you, Gaylee. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
My thanks to Ms. Summerton for agreeing to appear on the podcast. Once again, the Bolshoi Ballet production of Spartacus is on Saturday, November 20th at 1 p.m. And the Fredonia Dance Ensemble will be running Friday, November 12th at 7:30 p.m. and Saturday, November 13th at 2 p.m. and again at 7:30 p.m. in the Marin's Dance Theater at Rockefeller Arts Center. Tickets for Spartacus can be purchased online at www.fredopera.org. or by calling the box office at 716-679-1891. And for the Fredonia Dance Ensemble, you can get tickets at www.fredonia.edu/tickets or by calling the campus box office at 716-673-3501. There's a lot to be thankful for with the 27 years that the Opera House has been running. And we would like to give listeners of this podcast an opportunity to let us know what they are thankful for about the Opera House and its programs. We've set up a special call-in procedure to let you leave a 20-second voicemail message telling us and the community why you are thankful the Opera House is in existence. We will broadcast those messages during our Thanksgiving podcast on November 24th, the day before Thanksgiving. I'll have a bit more information for you after the Dick Gilman and Jim Bolts interview. Too many people, it seems, believe opera to be a stuffy and inscrutable art form. But of course, for many of the great operas, they were the popular art form of the day. My wife's grandfather, who immigrated from Sicily and spent his working life making pasta at the Brooklyn Ronzoni factory, took the subway almost every Sunday afternoon to catch the matinee of whatever opera was at the Met. My own father, a physical education teacher, loved listening to opera and collected recordings of many of the great ones. Two people who are out to change the perception of opera as stuffy are about to present a production of Il Secreto Matrimonio by Domenico Cimarosa that is about as unstuffy as you can get. I talked with Dr. Robert Strauss and Mr. Dan Lenzian about the upcoming Hillman Opera production. Well, I'm pleased to have with me right now, I have Dr. Robert Strauss, who is on the voice faculty and is the producer of the Hillman Opera. Rob, you actually qualify now as the guest who has the most appearances on the podcast. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Well, I'm happy to be here.
Good. Glad to have you. And I also have the stage director with me. He's a lecturer of the Department of Theater and Dance, Mr. Dan Lindsay. Dan, welcome.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Great, great. So let's get started. I always like to get started to figure out why you picked this. I mean, I think I already know, but it's really good to hear from the producer.
And there are a lot of different reasons we came to this title. And I'll admit that some of it was COVID related. We wanted a title that we knew we wanted to be back on the stage. We needed to be back on the stage, but we weren't sure if we were going to have to be socially distanced or masked or if it was going to be half an audience. And the Cimarosa has a 6-person cast, which is unusual for the Hillman. Normally it's a huge ordeal. But this gave us the opportunity to double cast and have 12 individuals singing. And we have, ensemble members who serve as, I'll let Dan talk about that later because it's his brainchild. But we have about 20 students in the cast for the Hillman. But also, the Cimarosa, it's so interesting. This premiered 2 months after Mozart died. And it was premiered 22 days before Rossini was born.
Oh, my.
And yeah. And so as I sit and listen to it, I hear Mozart. Or, wait a minute, that's not Mozart, that's Rossini. No, it's got to be early Rossini. So it really, it's a brilliant opera. It's a hysterical, it was so popular in its day as well. There's a story that at the premiere, the emperor loved it so much that he bought dinner for the entire production and then had them do the whole thing again.
Wow.
And so that's our goal. Dan and I want to get dinner after this.
Well,
someone to buy us dinner.
Someone please. Has to buy you dinner. Okay, I'm sorry. Don't count on me. Dan, so the challenges of directing this particular piece then, what has presented, the greatest challenges for you and for the cast?
Sure. You know, we are definitely in a different cultural place than we were when the opera premiered. And so for me, it became very important because I think that through a contemporary lens, a lot of people see entertainment as realism. I think that we live in a world of like, we see things through reality TV lens of like, this is real, where the characters in The Secret and, the Cimarosa piece are not real people. And so I started kind of there and saying, how can we let an audience know that this is absolutely not realism and should not be looked at as aspirational in any kind of way? Through the design team of Hyla Stahlhorn and Jess Lustig, we had some great early conversations. And when I sort of brought up this idea of non-realism and all this stuff, we realized that the sort of world of the play could exist within sort of the reality of a 1980s primetime soap opera. Mm. And so there is a pull and sort of a visual element of a dynasty and a Dallas. And I think that when we see those archetypes on stage, we realize this is not reality. In addition, the set has taken on, it sort of looks like a traditional opera set, but there is a big twist in the sense that it is in some ways monochromatic and the sort of color change will switch. But that's also sort of really taking care of our audience and saying that this is not realism. The set is made to look not realistic in this sense. And I think it's a colorful, fun confection that allows us to laugh and escape and have a really good time.
In 1,000 years, I never would have come up with something like the mid-80s dynasty things. I guess now I'm thinking of cowboy hats and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, you own 53% of that company. Yeah. And so, and you know, and then, so then from there, with the cast of the ensemble who are so integrally involved, so sort of integral to this production, I worked with them, right, and sort of said, Here are some jobs that might be within the world of this. What jobs are interesting to you? And, you know, we started to create these really fun, wonderful characters that also exist. In addition, I was talking to a friend on the phone last night saying, you know, I don't think, and, you know, if Chimarosa could see this production, he would think that there would be like a tennis instructor and a financial advisor on stage. But it works in this kind of really beautiful, fun way that I every night I watch it and I'm just tickled pink by or maybe green with envy in terms of the production. Another interesting thing about sort of to go on with the challenges is that this production is fully masked, and we made that decision really early. But I think that the fascinating thing about it is that, you know, through luckily through movement work and movement training, right, the sort of a cloth mask is almost like, you know, what would come from the Lecoq School of Movement, a neutral mask. And so it's really great to watch the actors tell the story through their body and through blocking and the reaction of it. And it's fascinating to kind of, you get such a clear sense of character and a clear sense of story, what they're doing, even though they're masked. And it's a testament to them and just a testament to the spirit of the Hillman Opera that this is happening and the storytelling is so keen and so fine.
Rob, I'm interested from your point of view as a musician and longtime opera singer, how what was your reaction to something like this, the conception that Dan has for the show and the actual musical score?
Well, I love it. It works so brilliantly. I mean, there've been very wonderful and strange, you know, a production of Così fan tutte, which is set, Benjamin Franklin is one of the characters and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so that's always happening in opera and especially comic opera. But I think, you know, setting it Dallas Dynasty, you mentioned cowboy hat and you were joking, but by the way, spoiler alert, there might be one.
Oh my gosh.
maybe, I don't want to reveal too much.
Okay.
Or a big belt buckle. I don't know. There might be something. But I think, you know, and also for our audience, you know, it's something that at least people my age and, you know, even people younger like Dan, like, oh, that's J.R. Ewing.
Right.
I get it. I understand this. It's right. Not, you know, oh, is opera not stuffy? Maybe this opera isn't stuffy. And then right. And then we can go, opera isn't actually stuffy, except when it is supposed to be. So I love it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a wonderful, I'm really excited about hearing about that. And I think that, you know, having something that's modern looking and then putting them to that kind of music is probably going to be very successful.
Yeah, I think so. I think Dan has done a great job. And, you know, the plot is so ridiculous and wonderful and farcical that.
So let me ask Dan to give us a brief plot synopsis for people out there who are not familiar with the piece, Il Matrimonio Secreto.
Yes, the secret marriage. We discover within 2 moments into the play that Paulina and Carolina are married, but they have been married in secret and they live it. And Carolina is the daughter of Geronimo. Geronimo has always wanted a title and wanted money and lives with his elder sibling, Fidelma. He has plans or Paulino has set up that his eldest daughter, Elisetta, will marry a count. But when the count arrives, he is not interested in Elisetta, but interested in Paulino's current secret wife, Carolina. Hilarity ensues.
Hilarity ensues. Okay. I always like when the, you know, you can take a any kind of play and put the synopsis out and then just simply say hilarity ensues.
Right.
That makes it so simple.
I realize we haven't mentioned the ridiculous thing that I did to you and everything in the two casts. One of the soprano roles or mezzo roles is sung by a tenor in one cast and in a mezzo in the other. And the baritone role of the count in one cast is sung by a baritone, but in the other by a mezzo. So we have interesting, you know, gender presentation and gender identity is just sort of thrown out the window. But you see one cast and you see one thing, at least what you feel like you're looking at gender-wise, and a completely different thing in the other cast.
I am getting a very clear impression that this is not your grandfather's opera.
If your grandfather's cool, it is.
Well, at least I'm getting to that grandfatherly stage, so maybe I can be cool enough to be part of the audience.
I think you definitely are, and I think that I would sort of recommend to anyone if they would like to come and check it out and laugh and have a good time and not have expectations. I think that this we did try to make an opera that would be a great entry point for anyone who's never seen an opera to have a great time. And perhaps become a fan of opera and the Hillman Opera, right? And also, I want to say that as much sort of maybe foolishness that's in the staging, our conductor, Dr. David Rudge, has really, and our rehearsal accompanist and harpsichord player, Dr. Ann Kissel, have worked so hard to honor everything that Cimarosa has written. So there isn't any shenanigans that are happening with the music, right? The music is being so fully respected. So I hope for an aficionado who would come to see the play that they would also say, this is the thing that they're doing, right? And they're doing a really respectful, excellent, fully prepared job of this. And so I wanted to make a piece that was inclusive as possible. And I think that we have done that. And I also want to say that although it is being sung in Italian, there are super titles that are above the stage. And so it is being super titled in English for the entire time, which is also, I think, a really great way of making things accessible for people.
Yeah, that's always, I think it's always a good choice. It's always a good choice to let the students sing it in the language it's written to, I believe. Give me the lowdown on, dates, times, that kind of thing. And also, if you can, I know this is double cast, which nights, which cast performs? That's always, an important thing for people to know.
So it's Friday, November 12th and Saturday, November the 13th, both at 7:30 p.m. And then again, Sunday the 14th at 2 p.m. I know tickets are available fredonia.edu/tickets. Mm-hmm. Both casts are excellent. Mm-hmm. I'm supposed to say that. I know I'm supposed to say that. But it's absolutely true. The Saturday cast, so one cast is doing Friday and Sunday, right, and one cast is doing Saturday. The Saturday cast has some guests, some alum and faculty members.
Oh, nice.
Were in it, that just sort of came to pass as we felt it was really crucial that we had two casts in case anybody had to quarantine. And I'm going to knock on wood because I just said that, and we don't want it to happen. I'm fascinated each time I watch it. I'm also supposed to recommend that everybody goes to see both casts, but I think there's something really interesting about the slightly different story that each cast tells.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think that there are two distinct, really, really enjoyable, wonderful shows.
Gentlemen, thank you. Thank you so much. It was a delightful interview. I look forward. I wish you the best of luck on this. I think it sounds like you've done a terrific job to make opera so accessible to people. And, we'll encourage them to make sure they get a ticket and show up. Thanks again. I know you're in the middle of production week. So good luck. Toy, toy, toy to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
So you still think opera is stuffy? Then you should definitely get down to this production and have your mind changed, if not blown. My thanks to Rob and Dan for their time and their unique take on this production. The Hillman Opera will be performed this coming weekend, November 12th and 13th at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday, November 14th at 2 p.m. in the Marvel Theater. Not to be missed. Here are some reminders of other arts events coming up in the region in the next 2 weeks. If you still haven't gotten around to asking for a refund for your George Winston tickets, you still have time to do so. Just call the 1891 Fredonia Opera House box office at 716-679-1891 to inquire about your refund choices, or email us at operahouse@fredopera.org. Also, special box office hours to process refunds for the George Winston concert have been set up for Friday, November 19th, the original performance date, from 6:30 to 8 p.m. To claim your refund, please be sure to bring your tickets with you. You will need to fill out a short refund form and refunds will be paid in cash. The Fredonia Opera House Cinema Series continues these next 2 weeks with two films. The first, Dear Evan Hansen, is a film version of the successful Broadway play, with award-winning actor Ben Platt recreating his Broadway performance. It tells the story of an anxious, isolated high schooler aching for understanding and belonging amid the crisis and cruelty of the social media age. Dear Evan Hansen will be screened on Saturday, November 13th, and again on Tuesday, November 16th at 7:30 p.m. The second film, The Rescue, documents the daring rescue of 12 boys and their coach from deep inside a flooded cave in northern Thailand. Its screening dates are Saturday, November 20th and Tuesday, November 23rd at 7:30 p.m. You can make a double feature out of the Bolshoi Ballet and The Rescue on November 20th if you so choose. The Fredonia School of Music will be featuring the All College Band in King Concert Hall on November 11th. The Fredonia Wind Ensemble, also in King Concert Hall, on Tuesday, November 16th. And the Fredonia New Jazz Orchestra on Thursday, November 18th, in the Rausch Recital Hall. All these events are free, as well as available via live stream, and begin at 8 p.m. The Kaleidoscope series will be presenting Mark Neiser, Expect the Impossible, a one-man show featuring comedy, world-class juggling, and music, on Friday, November 19th at 7 p.m. in the Marvel Theater. And finally, the Marion Art Gallery continues its exhibit of wood prints by John Buck until November 19th, and will have its Fall Senior Showcase on display beginning December 3rd. So many choices. Who says there's nothing to do around here? When you consider these past 27 years that the 1891 Fredonia Opera House has been in operation, you realize that something like this could never continue to exist without the work and support of many, many people. The vision of a few people, however, is usually the spark that gets the ball rolling. And I had the wonderful opportunity to speak to two people who provided the largest sparks. Mr. Jim Boltz served as the chairman of the Theater Management Committee, which oversaw the initial restoration process, and Dr. Dick Gilman served as the first president of the Board of Directors of the Opera House. It was a truly enjoyable conversation. Well, I'm very pleased to welcome to the podcast two old friends, Dr. Dick Gilman, geology, retired geology professor from the college, and Mr. Jim Boltz. And it's good to have them both. So what I'm going to do, gentlemen, and maybe I'll start with you, Jim, is give you a little chance to talk about how you got involved in the Opera House and what your role has been through the ongoing years as we celebrate the 27th anniversary of the reopening of the Fredonia Opera House. Jim, why don't you kick us off?
I'll tell you, I sort of anticipated that as a question this earlier this morning, and I went over to my history that I did years and years ago, and I found four sentences I could use. If you could stand four sentences, it would reflect about a half a book of stuff and to get where we kind of came from. So I'd like to recite those four sentences if I could.
Go right ahead. And
this one goes back to 1982. Mayor Mancuso got a group of people together to decide what to do with the Opera House, with Village Hall. With that in mind and in need of very critical repair, would they decide to wholly or in part sell to a private developer and build a new structure for the town and the village. So that was the third, so he's getting this talked into amongst his friends there, the people in town.
Right.
Meanwhile, a small group of citizens quickly began to meet, represented by many from the from the college at Fredonia. So lastly, the society would then be responsible for operation, and the public voted unanimously to repair the village hall, and the society would overlook the opera house with management. So I would say we've come a long way in the last few years, apart from my terrible recitation just now. But that's how basically it started. What do we do? And then he really got going with the population, small gathering with his friends. And gradually, the Preservation Society came up in a couple of hundred people and was able to do a quite a fine initial collection to say that we definitely need this. We cannot have this beautiful building destroyed. So we won out. My and Dick being early members won out on that substantially. And so we're pleased about that. And I think we've come a long way in the time that's spent since then.
And what about you, Dick? How about how did you first start getting involved in that?
My first acquaintances with the Opera House when it was a movie theater. Carmen and I used to go to movies there anyway, and I suppose that would have been sometime in the late 60s or whatever. But when that all shut down and when they started doing some renovation, got really interested in it, thought that was a great idea. And the thing that amazed me at the time, I guess, was I was getting close to retirement age at the college, and I wanted to spend more time, I discovered, down at the Opera House. I thought that was a really neat place to be. I really enjoyed working with George Mallory, who was one of the first folks down there. And so I went down there as often as I could, and then I decided to retire a little bit early, actually, from the college, so I could go down there every day. And I just had a wonderful time down there. I thought that was a great facility that the village could provide. I enjoyed it. It was totally different from anything I'd ever done before. And so that was my introduction to the start of bringing back the Opera House, and have enjoyed every minute of it.
Now, when did you start to think that was going to be a nice place for the Newton Street Irregulars to perform?
Oh, as soon as I walked in there. I said, boy, the Newts are going to play here, I'll tell you. And but as soon as we really decided we were going to open, I put in the dibs for whoever, well, David Munnell was in charge by that time when we were ready to open. And I said, Dave, where the Newts are going to be part of the opening ceremonies, right? And he said, oh, yeah, yes. So that became the home stage, I guess you'd say, of the Newton Street Irregulars. Yeah.
I cannot imagine the number of hours that Dick and Carmen spent on the redecoration of that opera house and the number of hours that they spent up on the ceiling on that alone over a couple of years. They, unless they were getting high up there, I don't know what the inspiration was, but I think they put in more hours than anyone else I can imagine in the years that we worked there. He was phenomenal, and we owe them an absolute salute. This is apart from the fact that Dick was the president for a couple of years, and he did a great job at that too, of getting things together when there were some disagreements, like I had the same problem. But he was a phenomenal manager of the opera. He was just absolutely super.
Jim mentioned that the painting of the proscenium, when we came back from Maine, and they had painted part of the ceiling, and they had painted part of the real trim around the border of the ceiling. Gary Eckhart had a crew that was doing that. But then school was going to start. Gary was not going to be available. And so Gary showed Carmen and me how to do all the fancy painting around the border of the ceiling and around the proscenium. And we had staging that would get us way up to the top so we could get up there like Michelangelo, sort of, you know, with our noses next to the ceiling and do the painting. We'd go up there, and a couple of days, we even took our lunch. Carmen and I both would go up there and paint on the ribbon work that went around the proscenium. Gary showed us how to do it. It's about 8 layers of paint after we had it cleaned. And we would go up there. And in fact, when we got right to the top, it was like Michelangelo, because we took a padding from a chaise lounge, hauled it up there, and laid down on our backs. The ceiling was about 8 inches away from our nose. And we'd sit there with the paint dripping down our elbows and painted the fine detail on the ceiling and on the proscenium. It was a lot of fun to be up there. The view was fantastic. And now everybody will know, because I don't think I've told the people before, but we signed our name on the very top part of the ribbon on the center of the top of the proscenium. We signed it, Carmen and Dick Gilman, and we dated it in paint. So sometime in the future, when they get around to cleaning or repainting, there's going to be somebody up there and say, "Hey, Fred, who the hell is this Carmen and Dick Gilman guy?" But we signed our work. It's up there for all to see sometime in the future.
Jim, can you tell me what your reaction was the day that the Opera House actually opened for business, shall we say?
I guess my happiness was hidden because I was so busy running around and making sure that things were right. And Dick knows what I mean. You're the proprietor and you want everybody to be happy and pleased with what's going on. And my only problem was with someone. His wife was at the dinner before the opening night, which was fantastic at the White Inn. And he had the point that he could do anything he wanted to. And he walked in when the place was about ready to start the opening. And I've forgotten who it was. Either I or one of my friends made a space for him because he had a pretty good wallet, a good bank account, and helped. Anyway, we got him seated, but that was the most embarrassing part. We had to find a place and we didn't. And I think I or one of my friends gave up a seat and sat somewhere else away from their wife. And that was the only awkward place of the whole thing. Otherwise, we were bubbling over, just ecstatic. And I think there's not anyone who didn't have a smile on their face. And that's what I was looking for. I was more interested in appearances, facial appearances, and the fact that people were smiling at one another without drinking too much. but it was a good program because it was put on by locals, and people knew the stars very well, and it was opening night, and in brief, I was ecstatic, but I think I got to sleep okay at 3 a.m. After I calmed down a little bit. But it was a good night. I was ecstatic because all the preparation had been fulfilled.
Yeah, no problem, Jim. What about you, Dick? You did all that work and then it opened up. How did that feel?
Really exciting. Kind of nervous because the Newts were going to play. The Newts took part in the opening night festivities. But to walk out on that stage with your musical buddies and to sing after all the work that had been gone into it by the hundreds of volunteers that helped to bring it about, it was really, really exciting. It was a great night.
In recent years, I can name again something that's happened that I'm just ecstatic over also. And that would be, we struggled so hard initially to get funds, to get this thing to happen. And it gradually got better. But in the last couple of years, the state of New York has been so impressed with the money that we've used that for and correctly. And they've come here with visitors of their own to inspect it. They have, at least on two occasions, come to us to offer us money without our even asking for it. And they're substantial pieces of money. I'm talking about $100,000 to $200,000 in that area. And they knew exactly, you know, what we would do with it. It would go right into the building itself and something that we do. So they knew it was going to be used well. So it's a good thing to think of the state of New York doing something, you know, in a small town like this, and not just asking for money, but having it come to you without inquiry. And so here, tell us what you want to do with it. And of course, we're going to meet all the specifications. So it has happened.
So it's been 27 years. Let's see if I can I get you to perhaps pull out maybe one memory out of those 27 years you think stands out for you?
I'm not one for funerals and events like that, but I have one for my wife who passed away a few years back. And I was delighted to have it end in the Opera House by because she was a musician as well as a teacher and a good one, very good one. I had several recordings made originally years back of where she had performed. And I selected one in particular that I thought was short and that something that the people who came, and the place was loaded, by the way, with people rather than with drinks. I had the service finished with a recording that I had made that was only 2.5 to 3 minutes long. And it was gorgeous. It was on the pipe organ done at Rockefeller Center at the college. And I don't know, I think the greatest thing that moved me was to have a number of students and teachers, especially teachers in the music department, come up to me after it was over. Some couldn't stay for the reception elsewhere, but they said, it is the finest service I've ever had in my life. And it choked me up. And that got me emotionally. That would answer partially your question.
For me, there are a couple of things. One is the enormous community support that we have had. We have now, I think, over 500 members, paying members, who are part of the Opera House. So that kind of support in this small village is just outstanding, I think. The other thing is that early on, Jim and I met with Grant Cooper over at the college one time, and we were trying to think of what kind of program could be put in there of Grant's interest. And Grant said, boy, you know, a small orchestra, kind of a broke type orchestra or something like that. And that was the start of Bach and Beyond. And I think I will remember forever the fuzzy feelings that I had on that first performance that weekend of Bach and Beyond, Grant up there and with his orchestra of, I don't know, 15 or 20 young musicians. And the music just poured out of that stage. I was sitting up in the balcony and I thought, my Lord, what a wonderful thing to have in this community. And, you know, fortunately that has been something of every year until COVID kind of knocked it out, but we'll be back. We'll be back with that. And that whole program of Bach and Beyond has been so wonderful in my mind. That's certainly one of the highlights.
What do you, Dick, let me ask you, what do you see for the future of the Opera House? What would you like to see most to happen in the future?
What I would like to see most, without question, is to see a fanny in every one of those chairs for everything we do. It's building the audience, and that's really tough to do. I remember when in those first years, I thought at one time I thought if it was still open after 5 years, that would be a huge a huge victory for the Opera House. 5 years came, and 5 years was long history now. We still have very few performances in which we would have a full house. We seat over 400, and lots of times, you know, 200 is a good house. If we could just keep that building up, and gradually it is building, but we always need more seats, more fannies in the seats, as one of the ex-board members once said. I had always thought originally that I would love to see some theatrical performance, some plays in there. And I know there are huge, huge things that have to be done. We don't have any wingspan. We don't have any place to fly vertically, sets and stuff like that. One of my hopes is eventually we might be able to do some kind of theatrical productions there, as well as the music stuff. And then I'd like to get stuff of the younger crowd, maybe the school age kids, certainly the college kids use it. Once in a while, they do opera scenes there. They do now. Just more of what we do, and a little bit of branching out now and then to kind of get outside the box. But right now, we got to build back from COVID. That's our big challenge right now, is to bring back those people that we had, and indeed some new ones. You know, there are still people in Fredonia, Dunkirk, Northern Chautauqua, that don't know the Opera House is there, or they don't know what we do. Now, the brand new lights out in front has helped immeasurably. I love those lights.
They're great.
And to see those blinkers go around and see what's coming up next. And you know, we waited years and years and years to get the state to say that we could do that. And we finally persevered and got them. And I think they're wonderful. I think they add some color to downtown. I don't think they detract a bit. But stuff like that, you know, we're building, we're constantly making progress. Sometimes it seems like it's too slow, but we're getting there.
We're getting there, that's yeah, for sure.
We're getting there.
Jim, any thoughts for the future from you? What would you like to see?
That's hard to dream in something like that, because you're trying to get a reading of what the audience would be. And it's changed so much, I think, even the last decade or two, that you almost have to be a magician to figure out what's going to bring them in, what's going to compete with television, what's going to compete with live entertainment that they have in the area. And draw them indoors. I really don't know. I think it's a mystery. And I think the specialists themselves are agonized by this as well. So I'm just not going to make a complete fool out of myself. I'm partially, but not a complete fool.
Well, you know, sometimes I have to tell you, Jim, that sometimes it's those mysteries that are most interesting to explore, right?
Yeah.
Well, gentlemen, listen, it's been a pleasure talking to you both. The memories are wonderful, and you guys are so great, and you've done so much for the Opera House. And, you know, I mean, hopefully this podcast will help get some more fannies in the seats. Dick, I don't know.
Oh, so.
But we'll do what we can as we move to the future. So I want to thank you both for agreeing to come on the show, and I appreciate the time that you took.
Thank you, Tom.
It's nice for having us. Tom, if I could just at the end, I think we all owe a real big thank you for all the hundreds of volunteers that spent thousands of hours down there doing the menial little jobs that had to be done. The support from the community has just been fantastic. So
okay.
I'll end with that.
All right. Okay. That's a great way to end, Dick, for sure. Okay. Gentlemen, thank you so much. Very much appreciated.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. Bye-bye.
Nothing like three old guys reminiscing about old times, no? My thanks to Jim and Dick for spending the time to come on this newfangled thing called a podcast and share their memories. If you'd like to let us know what it is about the Opera House you're grateful for after 27 years of operation, here's what to do. Just call this special number, 716 268-1123 and leave a 20-second voicemail message. Please let us know who you are and why you're grateful to have the Opera House in the region. You can let us know what your favorite events or series have been in the past or right now. Please take a few minutes to write your message down and read it so that we can get a clear, smooth audio file. All messages are subject to editing and will be screened for content. The deadline for submitting a message is Friday, November 19th at 5 p.m. This will give us time to review and edit the messages for inclusion into the Thanksgiving episode on Wednesday, November 24th. That number again is 716-268-1123. We look forward to hearing from you. And that's it for this anniversary edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat. My thanks to Ms. Angelica Summerton, Dr. Robert Strauss, Mr. Dan Lenzian, Mr. Jim Boltz, and Dr. Dick Gilman for being on the podcast. Notes from the Aisle Seat is a production of the 1891 Fredonia Opera House in Fredonia, New York. For more information on any of the Opera House's events, call the box office at 716-679-1891, visit the website at www.fredopera.org, or email us at operahouse@fredopera.org. Notes from the Aisle Seat is now available wherever you get your podcasts, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. If you like this podcast, please consider following us by clicking the follow button on our website and spreading the word through your social media feeds. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a Thanksgiving episode of Notes from the Aisle Seat, so don't forget to send us your messages. I'm Tom Laughlin, and until then, be safe out there and be kind to one another.